If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56diva.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
Maybe you're in the business world, maybe you're in the broadcast world, maybe you are neither. You'll still enjoy Never Ride a Roller Coaster Upside Down, the ups and downs and reinvention of an entrepreneur by Jeff Smullyan, who is the founder and CEO of a company called Emmis. You've probably heard that name. They're big broadcasters across the country. Not that this is a name-dropping book, but here are just some of the names that you get a sort of behind-the-curtain peek of. Don Imus, David Letterman, Paul Newman, Jerry Reinsdorf, Paul Volcker, Peyton Manning, Ken Griffey Jr. The list goes on. Every time you turn a page, you go, really? You were doing a deal with that guy? And that guy is Jeff Smullyan. Hey, Jeff, it's John Williams. You're on WGN in Chicago. How are you?
I'm great, John. Good talking to you.
And by the way, speaking of name dropping, I have to say this out of the gate. Bob Surratt says hi.
Tell him I said hi. Tell Bob I said hi.
So
it's been a while.
You did work with our Bob Surratt, huh?
I think a while ago. At my age, I forget things, but I'm pretty sure that's right.
Oh, I was hoping you could give me some dish. You could say, and here's the thing that he doesn't want you to know.
I probably could have, but, you know, at advanced age, I forget these things.
Well, you remembered a lot in this book. I mean, tell for those who don't know, I know your story both in the industry and having read this book now, but for those who don't know, let's just start with you in Indianapolis at a daytime radio station. What were your beginnings?
Well, I started, my background, and I'm from Indianapolis, family's been here forever, went to school at USC, was going to get a master's and got a law degree instead. And then my dad talked me into coming back. He had a chance to invest in a small station. My goal was always to start my own radio company. And he said, well, come back and do it at home. And the first station we ran was the one where we hired David as our midday guy, David Letterman. And then did that for a few years and then started my own company over 40 years ago. And Emmis has done all sorts of crazy things since then, John.
Including a venture into professional baseball, missed opportunity in the NBA, which was historic. You talked about that. But let's go back to Letterman for a second. I know he was a TV weatherman. He was a host on your radio station?
Right. We hired Dave from Channel 13, where he was doing weekend weather. Thought he was hilarious. And brought him in to do midday talk and... The funny thing was Dave and I are the same age, and he appealed to a lot of younger guys in those days. And the older listeners, I think, were just completely befuddled. I told a story one day. I came back from lunch, and I had a listener call saying, you know, Letterman's a communist. And I said, well, why do you say that? And he said, well, I called him and told him, I know there are communists in Carmel, Indiana, which is a suburb of Indianapolis. And he said, do you know what he told me? I said, no. And he said, well, David said, you got to give the communists Carmel because the streets are always torn up and the football team's lousy and you can never find a decent parking space. So give the communists Carmel and hold the line at the next suburb. So David did all sorts of crazy things like that.
And did you know he was going to be the David Letterman we knew him to be?
No, nobody could. But you knew how much talent he had. In a world in which it takes some luck, you knew that he had the talent to make it.
In a world in which it takes to make some luck. But it's more than that. To be successful in business, and I think your stories apply to broadcasters, but to business people in general. Mm-hmm. And you've made it to the top. So just give me some aphorisms. What are some truths about being successful in business?
Well, I think it starts with, number one, creating the right culture. I've been fortunate to be surrounded by really wonderful people. Many of them have been here since day one. Love what you do. Have fun. I think, the last line of the book, my mother's line, in life you just have to have fun, and I think that's really true. Dealing with adversity. John, I think every human being is going to have it. We've certainly had it here. There were times when our industry collapsed, the company collapsed, and we just sort of were able to focus and get through it, which I'm probably as proud of as anything. and then being willing to take chances. And probably the most important thing is your integrity. I've told my kids, if your word is good, nothing else matters. And if your word isn't good, nothing else matters. So I think the most important thing is be truthful with the people you deal with.
You know, you recalled that when you were talking about your assignment as a special ambassador in an international conference about communications. And I think that was one of the most eye-opening things in the book, all of these other stories notwithstanding. I'll ask you to get to that in just a minute, but what was your relationship like or is like with the Reinsdorf family?
Well, Jerry was head of ownership. So when I came into baseball, Jerry was sort of head of ownership and evaluated us. It turned out we had some mutual friends, and Jerry really became like a big brother to me. I always tease Jerry that he loves being a curmudgeon, but deep down he's one of the kindest people I've ever known, also one of the smartest people I've ever known. So he's been a big brother to me for a long, long time.
The Reinsdorf that I think we've come to live with and know, he's not that public in Chicago, but it's a guy who, if you're his guy, he is loyal to you, but almost to a fault. I think we've seen him make some decisions and we go, I don't think that's in the best interest of the organization or the city, but it's the best interest of the guy that you're advocating for. What would you say about that, Jeff?
Well, I think that's a common trait. I have said sometimes you go the extra mile for people. Sometimes you go the extra mile and you shouldn't. It's a trait that I happen to have as well. And so sometimes, you know, the loyalty will cause you problems. But I think it's also a kind of a nice trait to have.
Why did you try and buy a baseball team? So here you are, this entrepreneur in broadcasting. What's this thing with baseball ownership?
Well, number one, you know, we did it because we had done all sports radio. We had sort of invented the first all sports station. We dealt with the Mets. In those days, you could only own one AM and one FM in a market. We were pretty much full in the major markets, and we were kind of looking for something. And in those days, people looked at it and said, boy, these guys are really wizards at marketing. I love Seattle. I had been there as a kid. Loved baseball, had grown up with it, had been a baseball fan all my life, and also saw some trends about the regionalization of television that intrigued us. So it was an opportunity that, you know, it was kind of, in those days, we bought a lot of things that weren't working and turned them around. And the Mariners are kind of the biggest fixer-upper in baseball.
So talk to us a little bit about that. How did that go for you?
Well, I have a chapter in the book called, I have a favorite saying, John, the line between being a genius and an idiot is very fine, and I've been on both sides. So one chapter is when we started WFAN, the first all-sports station, and the chapter is called Idiot to Genius, because I wanted to do it. Nobody else did. It was a disaster for a long time, and then when it turned around, I became a genius. And then we bought the Mariners, and I was kind of the boy wonder, and I was like a public figure signing autographs, and everybody loved me. So I started as a genius in Seattle, and when it didn't work, I became an idiot. And I have a favorite saying, everybody should be a pariah once in your life. And if you own a baseball team in Seattle, you get that opportunity.
It's hard to imagine that there was once a world where sports radio wasn't, you know, just a staple of every city.
Right.
But, I mean, we've got three sports stations in Chicago. Peoria has a sports station. And if they don't, they have a syndicated station or a station that syndicates sports radio. How did we have radio without sports radio?
Well, it was an idea that I had when I was in college at USC. And when we bought the Doubleday stations, we bought two FMs and an AM, and we were thinking of what to do with the AM, and I brought up all sports, and most of our people said, really stupid idea. And we're a very collaborative company, and we had a manager's meeting, and it got voted down. And one of my friends said, what do you do? I said, you cannot lead where others won't follow. So we're not going to do it. And the next day, a couple of my senior executives came in and said, look, we're really doing well everywhere else. We owe you one. We still think it's a stupid idea, but let's do it. That was the birth of sports radio. And I'll tell you a Reinsdorf story that you'll probably appreciate. Sports radio really changed how the people in sports dealt with the world, because whether you're an owner or a player or a manager, in before sports radio, if somebody wrote a negative column in the Tribune or the Sun-Times, they wrote something bad about you, you saw it at 7 in the morning, and you put it down. But with sports radio, you were really being, you know, able to be criticized 24/7. And it really changed everything. You could be a ball player and have a bad game, and you get in your car and turn on the radio station and hear what it, you know, what an idiot you were. So it changed everything. And Jerry was in Seattle one day, and he was driving around, and he heard one of the sports talk show hosts talking about me making some stupid decisions. And he said, you know, I'm not a religious guy, but the fact that the guy who invented the format that really ruined all of our lives and put us under a microscope 24/7 now owns a baseball team and is getting ripped by his invention proves to me there's a God.
I'm thinking of the scene in Moneyball where Billy Bean's driving around listening to the radio and suffering the criticism that is being slung at him, and we just take that as something for granted. It's part of the business, but it wasn't always. So that had to sting a little bit. But when you went to Seattle, you were welcomed. You guys were creative. You guys were smart. You did fun things. Nobody was going to the ball games, and you were starting to put people in the seats. It didn't go well, and so this is what you wrote on your way out. The Times daily attacked every fiber of my being. The food columnist wrote that I picked bad restaurants. The TV columnist said my viewing tastes were awful. Editorial cartoons landed on the front page depicting me as a despicable individual who is worthy of complete scorn. It went on day after day, every story showing what a blight I was on Seattle's character.
Yeah, and it was, like I said, and it's funny because the first 2.5 years we were just heroes, and when we bought the team, we said, look, I joke now in retrospect, we didn't have the kind of money to lose $15 million a year. The radio business had some problems. We got a $12 million collusion payment that we weren't expecting, and the team could never get a cable TV deal in those days. So, and I said, look, we're going to give it our best shot. I think it's probably the best management me and our people have ever done. We invented things that in those days were revolutionary. We had date nights at the ballpark and top 10 lists and contests and a kids zone. And so things I'm very, and, you know, situational music. We had all sorts of fun stuff, and I'm very proud of it. But we couldn't generate the revenue. I got in trouble. I said, look, to really own a baseball team in this era before revenue sharing, if you want to own the Pirates or the Mariners or the Royals, you really have to be a billionaire. Now, if you want to own the Yankees or the Dodgers, if you have a paper route, you'll be okay.
Because the market would support you.
Right, absolutely right. So, you know, but I think I'm proud of the work we did. We just didn't have the wherewithal. And I think what got us in trouble, and I think made me a pariah, was we had a lease that said we had to offer the team to the city, and then we could sell it or move it. And I think nobody thought there would ever be a buyer that would buy the Mariners again and keep them in Seattle. Now, as it turned out, Nintendo bought it, and the team is still there. I think they had their challenges over the years, but I think that was the problem. People thought, well, if Smullyan puts his team up for sale, it's leaving here forever.
Would you, if you owned the Bears, move them to Arlington Heights?
Well, I would not. I'm sort of one of these people who loves things downtown. I realize Soldier Field's not really downtown. I live in a town where we put the basketball stadium and the football stadium and the minor league ballpark all within 3 or 4 blocks, and I think it makes a big difference to the life of the city. Now, Chicago's not Indianapolis, and you know, a city like this really needs all that in a compact area.
It's 11:48. We're talking to Jeff Smullyan, and his book is titled "Never Ride a Roller Coaster Upside Down: The Ups and Downs and Reinvention of an Entrepreneur." I alluded a moment ago to something that was almost jaw-dropping, and that was his tenure as a ambassador to the U.S. or for the U.S. to an international conference. Jeff Smullyan's book is "Never Ride a Roller Coaster Upside Down." He's an entrepreneur with a wisdom that I think benefits everybody, but it's just a fun page-turner. I have to say this to you, Jeff, too. When I was reading the book, I talked on the radio one day about why sports are so expensive for the average fan. and your chapter, The Siren Call of Sports Ownership, that lists the three reasons it's so expensive these days, television rich guys and obscenely rich guys, I thought was maybe the most helpful thing to people to understand the world. It's not just that you have millionaires and billionaires, it's you have a lot of billionaires bidding for teams that end up then overpaying for them and then passing the cost along because they can get rich doing it.
Yeah, it's really changed the economics of sports. When you see, you know, it used to be that when you bought radio stations, you paid 10 times cash flow, and that was really true kind of for sports. But you've had so much wealth created at the very upper end of our society that, you know, I think you're seeing sports teams trade, you know, for 150 times cash flow. Well, that's not an investment anybody can ever make a return on. That's just like buying a work of art and hoping that we create more staggeringly rich people who pay more money for that work of art down the road.
But the Dodgers used to take pride in keeping the tickets priced reasonably for a family to go to the game.
Right.
And you know how it is in Chicago, particularly with the Cubs. That just doesn't happen anymore.
And, you know, everybody's gone to the and you're competing against everybody else. So even if you really want to hold your prices down, you know that to get free agents and to re-sign your players, you're going to have to do the same thing. So you're going to have the best cable deal. You're going to have suites. You're going to have, you know, signage. And you're going to have to price your tickets aggressively because that's where the world has gone.
The Soviet Union falls. All these Eastern Bloc countries are now trying to figure out how to be independent states and have free speech broadcasting. You're called in to head up the U.S. delegation of an international consortium on this. What was that like? What happened there?
It was, you know, I had gotten to know President Clinton, and they asked me if I'd be interested in doing something, and I said if I could do something part-time. So they came to me because I, again, wanted to build Emmis, and they came to me and asked me to head up the U.S. delegation to the ITU's conference, and I had a delegation of 40 people, 50 people, and it was fascinating. I was a fish out of water, and I got thrown into a negotiation between Israel and the PLO and the Arab states. That was certainly the most meaningful thing I've ever done in my life.
There was a point, though, where Britain had a proposal they wanted that they then chose to withdraw. And as an ally of theirs, our position would be, well, then we should withdraw as well. We were sort of in lockstep. And you knew that was the right call, diplomatically and electronically. So you said, okay, we'll do it. And the people in the delegation said, but we haven't had approval from the higher-ups in Washington, D.C. So then what happened?
Well, one of my State Department lawyers said, I said, look, the British came to us and we're going to withdraw. They're withdrawing their resolution, so since we support them, we have to withdraw. And my lawyer said, well, you can't. And I said, well, why not? He said, well, Washington hasn't approved it. I said, well, call Washington. And she said, well, it's the middle of the night. I said, well, just send him a voicemail. And so we went through this whole thing, and I said, look, I'm not going to make my country look like a bunch of morons by supporting a resolution that's been withdrawn. And since this isn't my full-time job, if somebody wants to fire me, that's fine, but I am not going to do this. And she said, is that your final answer? And I said, yes. And she said, okay. And she said, you know, you've made the right call. So in other words, she had to explain to me what the rules were so that she could protect herself. But obviously, any other call would have been idiocy. But that was, you know, that sort of government.
It's sort of diplomacy. She knew that you were making the right call, but she was arguing for the wrong decision because that's just the slow machinations of government.
Right.
And
right.
And then you say, well, I don't care. I'm gonna do it anyway. And then she goes, oh, thank God.
yeah. That was. And there were some memorable moments. One day I was watching on the news when President Clinton was announcing that the Saddam Hussein had massed on the border of Kuwait. And I came down and the Kuwaiti ambassador said, you know, Mr. Ambassador, I need to know your country will defend me, will defend us. My family's there. And I said, yes, you will have the support of the United States government. And she walked away thinking, I guess, that I had been on the phone with Bill Clinton all night. And one of my people said, thank God you were watching CNN this morning instead of the Cartoon Network.
which I recall that episode in your book, and that was just one chapter. We're out of time, Jeff. This is AM Radio. We have a lot of commercials and news. I don't know if you're familiar with the format.
But A little bit, John.
I have to say thank you for your time today. The founder of Emmis Broadcasting, the Emmis Corporation, never ride a roller coaster upside down. It's like this. It's one dang thing after another, and it's been fun reading and nice talking to you. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks, John. Same here.